Hi, this is Tony Robbins. Normally, in this part of Power Talk, we have an interview, but instead, I want you to connect with a unique soul. And I'm going to step out of it and let him talk to you directly. And it's going to be in the form of a talk that a man named Art Berg has done for me in the past. Now, Art Berg is not a name you may recognize off the top of your head. He wasn't famous to most people, but he was more than famous. He was an extraordinary soul, and I want you to have a direct connection with him. You know, Art had the unique experience of, at the age of 21, traveling to his wedding, falling asleep in the back of the car, being excited, if you can imagine, about marrying his childhood sweetheart, and finally finding himself in a car accident because his best friend that was driving fell asleep at the wheel. The accident was so severe that it broke Art's neck, and he instantaneously became a quadriplegic overnight. Now, the story of his life and how he turned this around is an extraordinary story that would inspire anyone. It also reminds us all that we have no problems. Everyone wanted Art to settle for a life less than he deserved, but Art would never settle. And the beauty of it is he did it with such a smile and such grace and such playfulness and such heart that he was a man that always made me laugh and cry because he's the kind of person that we all want to be. And all I can say about Art is each year I brought Art to Master University because many years ago I met him and he thanked me because he had bought my tapes off television in the early 90s, those personal power tapes, and he listened to them and he used them to inspire himself to go even higher levels. He was already a businessman and a wheelchair athlete, but in 93, he set a world record by becoming the first quadriplegic to race more than 100 miles by completing an ultra marathon of 320 miles between Salt Lake City and St. George, Utah. Now you can imagine wheeling yourself and you're a quadriplegic and doing that 320 miles and doing it in 100 degree heat where the heat of the pavement of his hands was blistering his hands continuously. I mean, Art was a man with unbelievable will. Art, by the way, married that same childhood sweetheart. She's a beautiful soul. Dallas is her name, and raised two children. He became the president of the Utah Speakers Association. He traveled 200,000 miles a year sharing his message, and I was bringing him to Life Mastery every single year as one of the only speakers I repeated each year because I wanted to share him with people all over the world. And so I'm including this talk from Life Mastery for you personally because, unfortunately, Art, with all his life and all his love, passed away in his sleep just recently. And I want to honor his wife and his two children for all the beauty that he was and is in all of our hearts and minds. And his life was about celebration. And so while I have some emotion as I talk about him, it's only because he's such a good soul. I know that he, his spirit, and his message is alive, and I wanted to bring more life to you. So please sit back, enjoy, and connect with my good friend, Art Berg.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you very much. You know, the world is changing. And for a lot of us, it's uncomfortable. I remember in 1985, I was going to buy my first personal computer. My father, who had worked for IBM for 23 years, he discouraged me from buying it. He said that a personal computer was nothing more than an expensive typewriter. I suppose in 1985, that was probably true. But not listening to my father, something I'd been accustomed to doing most of my life, I went out and I bought one anyway. Spent $5,000 on my first IBM PC. Dual floppy drives. 256K, RGB monitor, 300 BPS modem. Piece of crap. Man, that thing is so slow, I can't even give it to a school. Now, I'm never going to get rid of that thing. It cost me $5,000. And if anything, it reminds me of how quickly things change. Fax machines, satellite transmissions, information superhighway, digital technology, changing the way we communicate, changing the way we do business, locally and globally. Things are also changing for many of us professionally, politically, culturally, environmentally. things are also changing for a lot of us on a personal level. You know, they say that if you're a woman who was born after 1960, in all likelihood, you'll have more husbands than children. Yeah, how many are still doing the math? A woman the other day said, but what's the difference between the two? Yeah, that might be a part of the trouble. I'm not sure. I mean, things are changing for all of us, technologically, professionally, personally. Now, some of us are being attacked on all three fronts at the same time. Makes it difficult, even for the best of us, to keep up. I have a 10-year-old little girl. Her name is Mackenzie. I have a 7-year-old son. His name is Dalton. A number of years ago, I overheard them having a profound conversation. My daughter turned to my son, and she said, "When I grow up, I'm going to be a mom." My son, not wanting to be outdone, he said, "I'm going to be a mom, too." She said, "You can't be a mom. You can only be a dad." Apparently, she's never watched Jerry Springer. He said, "I don't want to be a dad. I want to be a mom." She said, "Well, you can't be a mom. You can only be a dad." He got a little teary-eyed. He said, "I don't want to be a dad. I want to be a mom." My daughter leaned over, patted him on the knee. She said, "You can't change it, so just accept it." Now, there are some things in this world that you and I can't change. Can't change the weather, though imagine we could always choose to stay inside. Can't change our parents, but we could always be better parents or grandparents ourselves. Can't change your past, but we can make new choices today, which will impact our future. I'm not here to talk about those things that you and I can't change, but rather those things that we can change, those things that we can influence, those things which I believe make the impossible more probable in our personal and professional lives. As I travel the world and share a message with more than 250,000 people every year of a personal nature, whether it's with IBM, Coca-Cola, AT&T, or the Baltimore Ravens, well, I've found some common denominator among individuals and organizations that succeed and endure despite very challenging circumstances, as opposed to those who are frustrated and miserable much of the time, despite overwhelming opportunity. I found that generally those who are successful, happy, their conversation, their focus, their goals, all seem to be centered around things over which they have some influence or control. I find that generally those who are frustrated and miserable much of the time, or those who their conversations, their focus, and goals all seem to be centered around things over which they have little influence or control. Now, I'm not here to talk about things that you and I can't change, but rather those things that we can. In an era of unprecedented change, I believe those who succeed, endure, rise to the top are those who are willing to risk themselves, do new things, ask new questions, challenge old processes, and develop new skills. A few years ago, I was vacationing here in Hawaii with my family. My family invited me to learn how to scuba dive. Now, I had never enjoyed that experience before, and, well, I was pretty sure that I didn't want to enjoy it then. But my brother said he was going to throw me into the ocean anyway. He just thought that a little oxygen would be nice. So I agreed. So I went through all the safety instruction, the training, the education, all to learn how to dive. Finally, the time came to dive into the ocean. So I put a wetsuit on, air tank on my back, buoyancy compensator vest, a weight belt around my waist. They put the little flippers on my feet, and I'm not sure why they put the little flippers on my feet, but they said that it looked right. As they were dragging me into the water, I overheard one of my brothers say that I look like shark bait. I mean, I had a much better idea for why I'd been invited. Now, for those of you who've never scuba dived before, you wear a buoyancy compensator vest. Now, you can let air in or out of that jacket, and it allows you to rise or to fall in the water. Now, my jacket was full, so I was floating on the surface, looking to the ocean floor. I was very happy, extremely comfortable. But the instructor had a whole new vision for my future. He came up and he let all the air out of my jacket. So I began to descend towards the bottom. Now, there's only one problem, though, with my descending. With the flippers on my feet were tending to float more than my head. My wife says she has a theory for that. I mean, I went straight down to the bottom, 50 feet. I hit my head on the bottom of the ocean floor. My flippers were sticking straight up in the water. I mean, fish were looking at me strange. The instructor, who was eager to help, he came down and he let all the air back into my jacket. Now, I don't know what he thought I was going to do, but I went straight back up again, feet first. I passed my family on the way, and my feet surfaced at the top. Well, now my feet were bobbing above the surface. My head was still pointed to the ocean floor. The instructor must have been an engineer. Thought if I took my weight belt off of my waist and if I put it around my knees, that perhaps I would float flatter in the water. It was a brilliant man. And it would have worked too if it hadn't slipped down around my ankles. Well, now I just sank back down to the bottom. Only now I was just standing on the bottom of the ocean. And I would just kind of wave there like kelp. Now, my family, they were compassionate. From time to time, they would return. And they'd pick me up off of my rock and they'd stick me on a new one. I mean, I'm pretty sure that they were using me as some kind of a marker. I think that pretty much identifies why you're here. I think one of the great things about the time you've had to spend together here is that many of you are now prepared to go back into the world as markers. Individuals who are willing to risk yourselves, do new things, ask new questions, challenge old processes, develop new skills, be an example for good and peace. See, I know a lot of things. See, I know a lot of things about change, but none more than this. For those in this life who refuse to change, life will change for you. And then it is always a more painful experience. 17 years ago, I had massive change introduced in my life. 17 years ago, I left from my home in San Jose, California, to drive back to the state of Utah. I was on my way to get married. It was Christmas, 4:30 in the morning. We were 40 miles north of Las Vegas on I-15, when the driver of my car fell asleep at the wheel. The car hit a concrete barrier, and despite the fact that I was wearing a seatbelt, I was ejected from the vehicle, and I broke my neck on a desert floor. So I was left as a quadriplegic, paralyzed from the chest down. I lost use of my feet and legs, lost use of my stomach muscle, 2 out of my 3 major chest muscles. Lost the use of my right tricep, most of the strength and the use of my shoulders and arms, and I lost the complete use of my hands. And that was where my new life was to begin. The doctor said I'd have to dream new dreams, think new thoughts. They said that I would never work again. Although I was pretty excited about that one. They said that 93% of those in my physical condition would never return to work. They said I'd never drive again. For the rest of my life, I'd be dependent upon family, friends, to eat, to get dressed, or even to get from place to place. They said I shouldn't expect to go many places or to do many things. Said I shouldn't expect to get married, have children, and that never again in my life would I ever be able to compete in any type of athletic event or competitive activity. And for the first time in my young life, I was really afraid. And I was afraid that what they said might really be true. Now I realize, perhaps none of you will have an experience where you find yourselves with a broken neck on a desert floor the morning after Christmas on your way to get married. But I do know that every one of you who are coming to this room today have come here with your own fears, challenges, uncertainty, and doubt. In that, we've shared something in common. Perhaps for some it's on a personal level, others on a professional level. Maybe for others it's more on a cultural level, whatever it is for you. But when I laid in that hospital bed 17 years ago, more afraid than I'd ever been before in my life, and more uncertain about my own future, my mother came to my side, and she whispered this truth in my ear when she said, "Art, while the difficult takes time, the impossible just takes a little longer." And for me, suddenly a once darkened room began to fill with the light of hope and faith that tomorrow would be better. Now, while I may be paralyzed physically, I think we all have moments in our lives that leave us feeling paralyzed emotionally, intellectually, spiritually, economically, technologically, when we're overwhelmed by the changes that are happening around us, when we fear mistakes that have been made in the past, uncertain about how we're going to confront challenges that are sure to come tomorrow. We can become overwhelmed, paralyzed by our own sense of fear, uncertainty, and doubt, unsure of when, where, and how to take action. And the effects for you emotionally are the same as they were for me physically 17 years ago. And therefore, I think that some of the solutions may be similar as well. If you're looking back with me in time, 17 years ago when I broke my neck on that desert floor, 17 years ago when I was taken by ambulance to a hospital in Las Vegas, Nevada, and there I was pronounced as a quadriplegic, 17 years ago when I had to begin to relearn how to do everything again in my life. You ever felt that way at times? You ever felt like you've had to relearn things all over again? New ways of looking at things, new questions to ask ourselves, new challenges to confront. And so I had to begin to relearn how to do most things in my life. Now, I remember in the beginning, if I leaned forward even more than a few inches, I mean, I'd have the strength to push my body back up again. I remember spending hour after hour stacking little blocks on top of one another, trying to learn how to use my hands the way they were again. You know, it really wouldn't have been so bad if those little blocks didn't have ducks and lambs on the sides of them and the letters A, B, and C. Now, I realize that some of you probably are thinking to yourselves, "Now, wait a minute, Art, you know, you've said that you're a quadriplegic, but I see you flapping your arms around up there and using your hands, and I don't understand." By the way, that's a very good question, and I'm going to answer it for you now. See, if it's your goal in life to be a quadriplegic, I mean, I realize that I make it look fun. It's really not all that difficult. I mean, all you need to do is just break one of the seven vertebrae in your neck, which you could do in a variety of ways. I'll leave that up to you. Jumping off poles might be one of them. But it depends on which one you break as to how much damage you'll do. See, and I broke the fifth vertebrae down. Christopher Rees broke the first and the second. And that's why his disability would be different than mine, even though he may call it by the same thing. But that's why he can't shrug his shoulders or breathe without a respirator. But quadriplegic, quad means four, so technically, if you'd like to be a quadriplegic, you know, all you need is some form of paralysis, dysfunction, in all four extremities of your body. See, I still have no functional use of this right tricep. That's the muscle that makes the arm go up and down. So this arm just kind of sits there. I mean, I'd make a good waiter, although all I could do is go in a circle. And I still have no functional use of my hands. I mean, none of my fingers move independently, which makes it very difficult to communicate. Especially when you're driving. Nothing though that a popsicle stick and a little duct tape wouldn't help. I'm going to show you, though, how I use my hands. Everett, if you would, put your hand up in the air. And make your fingers or wrists go limp like this. Keep your fingers loose. Now bring your wrist back up. Notice your thumb and your index finger should come closer together. Okay, if they doesn't, it's a whole different problem. Okay, go down. They should go further apart. Come up, they'll come closer together. Down, they'll go further apart. Now, aside from the fact you all look ridiculous, that is a medical term that is called tenodesis. All that really means is you don't need the individual, independent use of your fingers in order to get some function from your hands. You can use the tendons in your forearm. And just by drawing that wrist back, it'll pinch those two fingers in close enough together that with a whole lot of practice, you can learn how to pick up a fork, shake hands, write something, many of the essential functions of life. So what does that mean for you? What does that mean when you're faced with some real challenges yourselves? What does it mean when you find yourself faced with your own fear, uncertainty, or doubt? I think we need to be more flexible, more creative. We need a greater capacity to adapt. See, I think that if we're going to make ourselves indispensable in this seemingly disposable world, it comes from often our willingness to change, to adapt, to do new things. How do we do this? How do we encourage it? I think it begins by learning how to focus on what we have and not always on what we don't have. It's human nature. We tend to focus on what we don't have or what we used to have or what someone else has, or if I just have that, then I could really do something with my life. And the reality is those thoughts are probably true. But I've discovered from my own experience that when I focus predominantly on what I do not have, I am very seldom productive. More often than not, I am more frustrated and discouraged. Before my accident, there were about 10,000 things that I could do. Today, I think that there are only about 9,000 things that I can do. But here's the secret. I still don't have time to do the 9,000. So either I could focus on the 1,000 I've lost, or I can enjoy the 9 I still have. And by doing that, I have found that more has become available to me in the process. When we focus on what we have, not always on what we don't have, then you and I will always find new solutions to old problems. In August of last year, I received a telephone call from the head coach of the Baltimore Ravens, Brian Billick, gave me a call and asked me to come and share a similar message with his players and coaches during training camp of last year. Delivered a message similar to some of the things that we're talking about here today and continued to join them for another 7 other games, including the Super Bowl. In the middle of the season, one of the players emailed me with a question, which I think would have some relevance to you here today. He emailed and asked, "How, with all my travel, do I continue to maintain any type of an exercise routine or workout?" My answer is not the one I think he expected. My answer was, when only 20% of your body works, it takes you 80% less time to do a workout. See, I think that one of the challenges that we have today is that we have too many choices. I mean, we have so many good choices, we find it difficult to focus on those things which are really the most important. We have so many good choices, we become easily distracted. We have so many good choices, we often find it easier to abandon our decisions and our goals than it is to continue to work on those which have some of the most challenges or difficulties. One of the advantages that I had is at the age of 21, most of my choices were taken away. And therefore, I had to make the choices that I had work. When we focus on what we have, not always on what we don't have, we'll always find new solutions to old problems. I received another call from Coach Brian Billick just about 30 days ago, in which he informed me that I would be one of only two non-Ravens to receive a Super Bowl ring. And I think of particular interest to those of you here in this room, last year, the name of my company is Invictus Communications. And they decided, the Ravens did, after some of the work that we did, that they wanted to make the word Invictus their mantra for the year. So after every game that they won in PSI Net Stadium, they would put Invictus up on their scoreboard. Now they decided that they only left it up for about 10 or 15 seconds, and they decided that they would not tell the media why it was there. They're just going to be their little secret. Every player carried around a card that had Invictus on it, as well as the poem by William Ernest Henley that was written in 1875. Midway through the season, when the Ravens had five games in which they didn't have an offensive touchdown, three games that they lost in a row, many people thought it was the end of their season. And Coach Billick called a special meeting among his players and coaches and talked again about what the word Invictus meant, why it was important, why this was their word, why this was going to be meaningful to them. Then, of course, the rest is history. They pulled it out from there, and they went on to win the Super Bowl. And every Super Bowl ring has Invictus engraved on each side. Seventeen years ago, the doctors and nurses brought me to a separate room in the hospital. And they explained to me, they said, are there different terrains in life? I said, you think? They said, you got hills and concrete, you got gravel, you got carpet, padding underneath of the carpet. They said, Art, because of the strength which you'll never have, in order for you to be able to get around at all in life, we need to order you an electric wheelchair. Now, I know it sounds like a lot of fun, but I was 21 years old at that time, and I had learned how to ask the really important questions in life. So I asked, I said, can you tell me, what color do electric wheelchairs come in? They thought for a moment, and they said, chrome. Now, I didn't have a lot that was chrome in my wardrobe, so I asked, I said, can you tell me what color do manual wheelchairs come in? They said, well, purple, red, yellow, green, black, blue. I said, I mean, I'd like to have one of those. Thank you. There are many other reasons besides color. They said, I'll tell you what, Art, we have an inside track in our hospital, and it's an eighth of a mile long. It's on linoleum. They said, Art, if you can push around that track in less than 30 minutes, we'll let you have a manual wheelchair. I thought, what a democracy. Well, the morning of the event arrived. Doctors and nurses all stood around, anxious to see if I would finish. Stopwatch in hand, mark my progress. Piece of tape across the floor, which marked the starting and the finish line. Then they clicked the watch, and they said, go. Might as well not have said anything. I mean, it took me about 5 minutes just to get across the line. This is very thick tape. But once I got over that first speed bump and had momentum on my side, I mean, I felt good and strong, confident. I thought I could conquer the world. Although I have to admit, though, it was a little embarrassing when the elderly gentleman in the walker passed me twice. But that's all right. I caught up with him later, and I knocked it out from under him. In California, they call that therapy. Well, I got down to the end of that first hallway. I thought I'd taken a wrong turn. I mean, my arms and shoulders began to tire. I wondered if I would ever finish. Have you ever felt that way at the end of a day? Have you ever felt that way at the beginning of the day? I went down the first hallway, the second, the third, find the last, crossed over that line just one more time in exactly 28 minutes. So I got my manual wheelchair. Thank you. But it wasn't long after that when I wondered if I had made such a good decision in my life. Have you ever done that before? Have you ever gotten started on a path, set a certain goal for yourself to achieve something? You insisted that you had to have something in order to be successful, and then once you got it, you wondered if it was such a good idea to begin with? I mean, now there's new things to learn. There's a new sense of accountability. It was that time of the year that I wanted to go shopping by myself. And I think you'd understand why. See, my being in a wheelchair, my wife likes to use me as a shopping cart. It wasn't so bad until she started bringing me back to the return cart rack. I had to pay a couple of bucks to get myself back out again. So I convinced her I needed to go shopping on my own. So I went to a mall in San Jose called Eastridge Mall. Three stories high, more than 200 stores. Now, I was on the third level, and even the third back down to the second again. Now, they have these long sloping ramps, which go from one level all the way down to the next. You know, as I sat at the top of that great abyss, and I looked into the valley below, I was so sure, so confident that I could manage this kind of a fall. I waited for everybody else to get off the ramp, and then I pushed off. Do you know, I noticed an interesting thing happened when I pushed off. I accelerated, and I started to go faster and faster. Now, I don't have the use of my hands, so I can only put pressure with the palms of my hand against the outside of the rings. I put more and more pressure against the rings. I kept going faster and faster. I put more and more pressure on the rings. I was going faster and faster. About that time, I began to smell burning flesh coming from my hands. I mean, I knew I was in trouble. Now, being the good Boy Scout that I was obviously more concerned for the safety of young mothers and children who are at the bottom of the ramp than I would be for myself. I mean, after all, what more can you do to hurt a quadriplegic? I mean, what am I going to do? Break my neck? Oh, no. I figure maybe I'd fix something. So I began to wave my arms. Get out of the way! Get out of the way! I mean, mothers ran to the right. Children ran to the left. But you know, I noticed an interesting thing happen when I went like this. I accelerated. Man, I hit the bottom of that ramp. I was at full speed. Now, I'm not sure how fast I was going. 80? 90 miles an hour? I mean, I raced right down to the middle of all those good folks, but now there was a store in front of me. And the name across the front of the store was A. Hirsch & Son Jewelers. Now, I don't know how many of you have ever heard of a bull in a china shop, but this bull was doing 100 miles an hour. And I had a feeling I was about to become a part of their layaway program. I mean, I raced right down to the middle of that store. I kept waving my arms. Get out of the way! I mean, salespeople were jumping over counters. Customers were hiding behind pedestals. They thought they were safe. Nobody was safe. But the man who really looked worried was the one in the very back. He was behind the repair counter. He was end of line. All there was. Do you know he had the look on his face? Like he knew we were going to get acquainted. Well, I'm a lucky man. Because they had carpeting on the floor and they had thick padding underneath. So I began to slow down. And I came to a stop. Right in front of the repair counter. The repairman, he looked down over the top of the counter and he said, "Can I help you?" Do you know there are about 100 folks behind me that are wondering the same thing? I said, "Yes, sir. Can you tell me what time it is? I'm in an awful hurry." Ironically, I believe that sometimes you and I miss some of the greatest miracles of life simply because we're always in a hurry. Now, when I was 15, I used to think, oh boy, I'll really be happy when I turn 16 because then I can drive and I can get out more often. When I was 16, I thought, oh boy, I'll really be happy when I turn 18 because then I can do what I want to do and I can go where I want to go. When I turned 18, I thought, oh boy, I'd really be happy when I get married, have children, and a family, and then I'll show my parents how you raise children. Then I got married, had children, a family. I think, oh boy, I'd really be happy when all my children are gone. We're always wanting something else, always wishing for something else, other than what we have, other than where we are. Some of the greatest miracles of my life have not come about by grand events, but rather by the little things I have chosen to do every day. It's often the little things we do individually that make the biggest difference. It's our relationships. It's how we communicate. It's what we're willing to save, not always spend. It's a willingness to contribute our time, our resources, our love. It's a willingness to donate blood during a time of need. It's the little things we do individually, collectively, over time, that often makes the biggest difference. And I have found that when I personally am faced with more frustration, struggle, and obstacles in my life, it is generally because I have ignored the little things for too long. Went back to that same hospital about a year and a half after I left it. Decided I wanted to try that indoor track just one more time. The one that had taken me 28 minutes. This time there weren't any doctors or nurses. There wasn't any stopwatch. Only the second hand on my watch. Piece of tape, though, was still across that floor. Cracked and yellowing. And then I took off. In exactly 1 minute and 58 seconds later, I crossed the line again. Some people wouldn't call that a miracle. But I do. And for the first time in my young life, I learned that dreams are never destroyed by circumstance. Dreams are born in your heart and in your mind. Only there can they ever die. Since that day, today I own and operate two companies. One is my professional speaking company, and the other is a .com. And as soon as I've lost enough money, gonna go public. I am a professional speaker, published author. Dreams come true for me in my life. Dreams come true, not in spite of my circumstances, but perhaps because of them. I've learned how to drive again. Dangerous thing for a quadriplegic, but that's all right. I've only injured a few. I mean, one of the advantages of being in a wheelchair is that you get to park in the blue space. I mean, I'm not really sure why they call those handicapped spaces, because they're perfectly good spots, as some of you've discovered. I go where I want to go. I do what I want to do. I'm completely independent. I take care of myself. It took me 4 years to learn how to put my pants on again. No, I wasn't naked that whole time. Took me 5 years to put my own shoes and socks on again. 6 before I was completely independent. 7 before I could travel the world by myself. 8 before my wife realized that I could do the grocery shopping too. Don't give up on your dreams too quickly. Don't abandon your vision, shared values, too soon. One of the more liberating experiences for me was learning how to drive again. One of the more effective vehicles I purchased in 1989 was a Plymouth Voyager minivan. Side door opens automatically on one side. A ramp drops out. I can wheel up into the interior. In this particular vehicle, there was no driver's seat. I could pull in behind the steering wheel. My wheelchair would automatically lock to the floor below. The ramp and door would close behind me, operate the gas and the brake using hand controls. I was out driving in the streets of Salt Lake City one afternoon, pulled up to a traffic light when another Plymouth Voyager pulled up alongside me. But he didn't have the new V6. 3-liter, fuel-injected. So all those teenage urges began to surge through my body. So I began to rev my motor a little bit. He revved his. I revved mine a little louder. He revved his a little louder. The light turned green. We both took off. Now I was fully a car length in front of him before we even got through that intersection. But as my vehicle was surging into the next gear, my wheelchair suddenly broke free from the locks below, and I wheeled straight to the back of the van. Now, as the other driver began to overtake me, in his desire to gloat, he looked. There's nobody there. I was wheeling my way back up to the front. Well, the message for you is this. In a world of change, some things should never change. Some ideals, some values, principles by which we live, which we should stay firmly locked to. And then when everything else changes around us, you'll find a sense of peace, confidence, vision. I don't know that you would have had otherwise. Some things we should stay firmly locked to. I got married to that same beautiful and wonderful girl 1.5 years after that fateful day. And what a blessing she's been in my life. As I shared earlier, we have 2 beautiful children who are the joy of our lives. 10-year-old little girl, Mackenzie, 7-year-old son, Dalton. And he has developed an attitude. He's discovered recently that I'm in a wheelchair. I'm not sure who told him. So now whenever I get upset with him, he just stands in the middle of the stairs. He says, "Come get me, Daddy." I've had to resort to throwing things at him. I think some of our most valuable lessons we learn from children when we're really listening. I mean, I'm convinced that my children have never heard me say the word no. Oh, I've said it. I just don't think they ever heard it. I mean, to a child, no means maybe. To a child, no means you should ask the other parent. To a child, no means I just need to rephrase the question. To a child, no means it's still early in the day. I can still wear you down. You tell a child, no, the answer is no, and they'll wander off to their room, draw you a picture, and write, I love you, mommy or daddy, on the bottom. How many have one of those on your refrigerator? That's because you've been sold. Because children intuitively understand that when they're faced with frustration, rejection, change. They only need to love, serve, and give a little more. And I'm not sure when we lose that. How quickly do you hear no? Some time ago, my daughter came home from school, all excited, because someone had taught her how to do a thumbs up. Somebody had taught her that when somebody gives you a thumbs up, it means you've done something exceptionally well, something in which you should be proud. She asked me if I knew how to do a thumbs up. So I gave her my thumbs up. I mean, that's it. That's as good as it gets. Now, I explained to her that it wasn't for lack of desire. It was just gravity. And for a six-year-old little girl at the time, that was okay. A few weeks after that experience, she was in a little dance recital with some friends of hers. My wife and I were both there to watch. She was so cute and adorable. But more importantly, as her father, I couldn't have been more proud. In a brief moment, as our eyes made contact, I gave her my thumbs up. When she saw me, she suddenly ran from her little dance group out into the audience, came over to my side, and held my thumb up. And then she said, there you go, Daddy. Now I can help. A marker possesses the ability, a desire, the willingness to help. It's catching people doing things right rather than always looking for them doing something wrong. It's celebrating someone else's success before we do our own. It's finding reasons to include rather than to exclude. It's acquiring the habit, giving others a thumbs up in our daily experience, saying, I think you're doing a great job. I think you make a valuable contribution. I think we see others who are frustrated, struggling. It's a willingness to hold their thumb up and to say, you know what? I can help. Before my accident, I was looking for a way to make a living. Since my accident, I began to look for a way to make a greater contribution, add more value. And I have made a significantly better living in the process. In sharing some of my experiences with you, I notice that there are some of you who have taken a few notes. I think that's admirable. Others of you now wished you had taken a couple of notes. Some of you, quite frankly, by looking at you, have never taken a note in your life. But whatever end of that spectrum that you're on, if something I've shared with you today would have some value to a family member, a friend, a peer, a lot of what I've shared with you today is available for free. You'll find it in videos, audios, you'll find it in files, articles, and you'll find it at artberg.com, artberg.com. I also have returned to the world of sports. I've learned how to play tennis, learned how to swim, just like a rock. That's all right, because I hold my breath real well. And I have found it is a lot less crowded on the bottom. For that reason, I've learned to scuba dive, parasail, snow ski. I play full contact rugby. Now, rugby happens to be the fastest growing wheelchair sport in the world. It came out of Canada in 1980, into the United States, and originally was called Murder Ball. They found it difficult to get corporate sponsors. So the name was changed to quad rugby or wheelchair rugby. There are now more than 70 teams in the United States. There are another 40 abroad. It's a Paralympic sport. Play it on a basketball court. Get more speed on wood than you can on grass. Play it with a volleyball. And our motto in rugby is that the hit isn't real unless it bends steel. And I race marathons. For 3 years, I trained for a race that was longer than any race I'd ever begun. For 3 years, I trained for a race that was longer than any quadriplegic at my level of ability had ever attempted. I trained for a race that was 325 miles long. For our friends who are here from outside of the U.S., it's like a bunch of kilometers. We have no idea how many. It would take me 7 days to complete if I could complete it. On July 2nd, 1993, I began that race in downtown Salt Lake City, and I headed in the direction of St. George, Utah. I learned something about that race, and I think it applies to you. I noticed that in the first mile of the race, there are a whole bunch of folks there to cheer me on. I noticed that in the last mile of the race, there are even more people there to congratulate me. But I also noticed that there was a whole lot of empty space for the other 323 miles. It's my hope. You're going to leave here after this time together with more energy, enthusiasm, passion for your life, the contribution that you can make than perhaps you've had in a while. But I also know, for many of you, this is when the 323 miles begins. It's difficult at times, lonely, uncomfortable. But I believe that you and I can fill that space, make it more meaningful, significant. If we're willing to risk ourselves, do new things, ask new questions, challenge old processes, develop new skills, be flexible, creative, adapt. Focus on what you have, not always on what you don't have. Look at that which for today challenges you, but look at it from a different perspective. Do the little things consistently well each day over time, even though at the moment they may seem insignificant. More than anything, nurture the ability, a desire, and the willingness to help. And I think for you, the impossible is probable. By the end of the third day of that race, more than 135 miles into it, my hands were so bloodied and swollen that the doctors had to cut the gloves off my hands. And they asked me to stop before I did permanent damage to my hands and to my body. I kept thinking, it's got to get easier than this. The next day, I had headwinds of up to 30 miles an hour. I had to push even going downhill. I kept thinking, it can't get any harder than this. Have you ever been tempted to think that? Well, then you know what happens next. For the next 3 days, it was more than 105 degrees. I raced on a freshly oiled road that was jet black, and I baked in the heat. I kept thinking, turn me over. It's got to get easier than this. On one day, I climbed from an elevation of 4,000 feet to more than 9,000 feet over 12 miles. It took 13 hours. You've had days like that. And you'll have more. On the final day, with police escorts on the front and on the rear, I raced those final miles into St. George. Traffic signals stopped. People lined the streets. Then I knew what my mother said was true. While the difficult takes time, the impossible just takes a little longer. I had a friend ask me shortly after. He said, Art, if you could change it all, if you could have flown a plane, loved a different girl, driven during the day, in order to avoid the pain, the frustration, and the struggle of your life, would you? My answer is this: no. Now, some of you may not understand. Some of you may even think I'm crazy. That's all right. If you knew what I knew, been where I have been, seen what I've seen, heard what I've heard, I think you would echo with me when I say, I thank God that life is hard. Why? Because in the pain and the frustration, the loneliness, the discouragement, the rejection, you and I begin to learn. When we learn, we grow. When we grow, the greatest miracle of all happens. You and I begin to change. I want you to know. I hope that you know. I believe in miracles. But I also know some miracles, some dreams, some impossibilities just take time. Thank God for that. God bless. Thank you.